Welcome to HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS. Each week at this time, we bring you updates on a different medical topic and open the phone lines for you to join the discussion. Now, HealthScope on 89.3 WMKV, 89.9 WLHS, and online at WMKVFM.org.
We welcome you to WMKV and WLHS and HealthScope here on 89.3 and 89.9. And today on Facebook, we promised you a breathtaking show. Actually, I'd rather think of it as a breath-giving show. We are going to talk about good lung health today, all kinds of lung and breathing disorders. And we have a very special guest here with us, I believe his first time here at WMKV Studios, Dr. Charles Kim from UC Health. He is with the UC Health Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine area. And assistant professor of medicine as well. Dr. Kim, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk for just a moment about our lungs and really how they function. I think all of us have an idea of what happens here. But are there some things about the lungs that maybe, well, I think we all take them for granted, but things about the lungs and how they operate that people would find interesting to know?
Well, I mean, the whole reason that we are here, what we're doing is to breathe, to sort of inspire, bring in oxygenated air, which is the fuel for our bodies, and to deliver to the red blood cells on a microscopic level. And then for that, exchange of oxygen for carbon dioxide, which is a waste product from body's metabolism, and then get that carbon dioxide out as well. And so that's the whole purpose of our lungs, is to sort of do that purpose. And anything that sort of makes that purpose go wrong or not work, can cause significant problems. It's actually called acute respiratory failure, and so that can be acute or chronic or sort of even acute on chronic. And so I think people do take breathing for granted. It's something you sort of have to do, but when you can't do it, that's when you really start to notice that. I mean, maybe life isn't so happy.
And when it is a labor just to be able to breathe, we realize how much we have taken that for granted. What we're here today is to learn maybe ways to avoid some of these complications, looking at red flags on breathing issues or breathing difficulties with Dr. Kim. I have to ask, though, before we open up the phone lines and talk more about some of the specific illnesses, how did you come to this area of medicine? What was your inspiration, if you will, for this area of medicine?
Well, I've been always wanting to be a doctor since I was a kid, and it's something that you sort of go through medical school. You sort of know that you're going to do it. You sort of have a feeling of what kind of things you don't like and what kind of things you do like. Blood, if you don't like blood, then you shouldn't be a hematologist or cardiovascular, cardiologist or a thoracic surgeon or anything. But if you like, if you don't mind phlegm as much, you don't like, coughing or bad breath, then the lung disease is not a bad way to sort of do it. It's also tied in with critical care and being able to take care of people in the ICU and when they're, very ill, that's something that's very rewarding if you're able to sort of help the patient and the family, get through a crisis, a healthcare crisis. Done something that I've really enjoyed doing, and I really think that it does really give a good good sort of career.
Well, and you're helping a lot of people, which is tremendous. Anybody who's been through either a respiratory infection, you hear about things like upper respiratory infections and things like that. But anybody who's been through anything like this with the lungs or the upper respiratory tract as well, we kind of see the result of that as we recover from things and we're literally bringing things up. I don't think most people don't really want to know what's really going on down in those lungs and what's down in there. I mean, it's there's a lot of mucus and a lot of things happening in the lungs. Is that correct?
Right. The lungs, are exposed to the environment in all the toxins and the microbes, with every breath in. And so, defense against those environmental agents are things that your body has to sort of fight off, continuously. And so part of the way is by lining the mucus or lining the airways with mucus to sort of help catch some of that, particles and debris and bring it up from the lungs to help sort of expectorate it and get it out of the lungs. And so And so so that part of the lung defense is you know, very important in when it doesn't happen, or when your body's doing what it's supposed to be doing. It can be very annoying and very and cause you know, other kinds of symptoms and complaints. But part of it is what the body's supposed to do, and it, you know, just like a microwave oven, it's great when it works. When it doesn't work, then, you know, life is a problem.
Or those people who enjoy like sausage, but people say you never want to see it being made.
Right.
Well, let's leave the lungs, the internal part, to the specialist who know what's going on in there. And we just, as long as we can breathe clearly and we're not wheezing or we're not gasping for air, we tend to take it for granted, as we said a few times here. What are some of the warning signs of lung issues or lung problems when we start talking about the actual operation of our lungs and our respiratory system?
Well, the as far as our common complaints that we sort of see, you know, can be things that are mild, like a cough, or you know, the feeling of not being able to catch your breath or not being able to do as much as you're normally able to do before you have to stop and catch your breath. You know, changes in your breathing when you're sleeping and wheezing. Those are very common sort of things. And then there are some things that could be very serious that need to be dealt with very quickly. Chest pain or altered mental status, and those kinds of things are some, you know, warning signs as well. But a lot of times, it's a matter of how good your lungs, you know, have been until all of a sudden they're not, and then you start noticing you have problems. And that's one of the problems with you know, the way the lungs work. They work so well that we have so much capacity that we don't need to use it until we sort of really need to use it. And when it gets to a point where you're not using it as much, and you start to know that I can't use it as much as I used to, then you know, those signs can be, you know, a tale of there's something going on.
And also things like, and I know I'm probably jumping way ahead here, but things like everything from smoking to secondhand smoke and things like that, can those be cumulative as far as things that can damage the lungs? Or if we get away from, let's say, that secondhand smoke or smoking, can the lungs do some degree of healing as they recover from exposure to things like that?
So the way that we sort of look at smoking is we talk about it in pack years. So how many packs, you know, per day mm-hmm. that you smoke, for how long you've smoked. And that gives us a, you know, an estimate of for how much, you know, long-term, you know, exposure that your lungs have had to basically something that's a toxin. Other things like work, some kind of work environments, and, you know, asbestos and fumes can be also very toxic to the lungs. The amount of time that you spend away from those toxins, you know, it allows your lungs to sort of heal, and the other parts of the lungs to sort of work a little bit better until you can. But sometimes, you know, the damage is done. Once the damage is done, it really is sort of done. And that's why it's hard to know what the early sort of warning signs, you know, sometimes can, you know, be the sort of ice, you know, the tip of the iceberg of bigger problems.
And I'm sure one of the things that you hear here in Cincinnati, not only do we seem to have everybody thinks that their city is the worst for allergies and asthma and things like that. In Cincinnati, we've got high humidity. We have generally high mold counts, things like that. I hope that we can talk throughout the program maybe about how allergies even tie in to how well your lungs operate and how they function. We think of it often as dealing with the upper respiratory or even up in the nasal area, but it can affect the lungs as well, can it not?
Well, the whole, you know, pulmonary system is, you know, really goes from, you know, inspired air from the nose, you know, down to the smallest units of the lungs. And so any rest, you know, anything that interrupts that cycle or that sort of passage, you know, can make it harder to sort of breathe. And so the allergens in our area are very sort of, you know, patient specific. But there is a list of the sort of 100 most challenging places to live with fall allergies.
Uh-oh.
Louisville is number one.
Really? Wow. Well, they're on a river as well.
Right. Dayton is number four. But Cincinnati is actually number 54.
Wow.
And so it's, you know, so right here where we're at is sort of somewhere in the middle between the fourth and the 54th worst, you know, most challenging places to live.
You ask anybody in Cincinnati and they're going to tell you we're like one with a bullet or something. I mean, everybody, as I said, everybody thinks they live in the worst place, but it does come into play though. And I think this is one of the things, and I guess the question, how do environmental and geographic location really affect our lung health? This obviously is something that I think is of concern to a lot of people out there.
Right. You know, it's I always joke with my patients that, you know, the insurance companies won't pay for a prescription if I say move to Arizona or move to Hawaii.
That's a great point.
But one of the things that you really can't do is you can't sort of change the environment, you know, as much mm-hmm. As you'd sort of like to. You can be insulated. You can be inside and using different kinds of filters in your air conditioning and things like that can help reduce things. But to get 100% control is not really, you know, reasonable. And so, you know, other things, you know, like medicines that you can take, a lot of them are over-the-counter medicines to sort of help reduce symptoms, you know, and you have to sort of think about things in the fact that, again, everything is, you know, starts at the nose. And so even, you know, topical nasal sprays can be very effective in sort of helping reduce some of the symptoms. But, you know, the best sort of option is to sort of get away from the, you know, the allergen, the thing that sort of makes your body overreact. And again, you know, most insurance companies won't pay for
right. an airplane ticket or right. moving costs, right? We have Dr. Charles Kim here with us from UC Health. He is with the Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine area of UC Health. And he is also Assistant Professor of Medicine with UC Health and the University of Cincinnati. And we are thrilled to have him here with us today because we're talking about really good lung health. And you've already opened so many different possible areas, including things like sleep apnea and whatnot, as far as just our overall health and how our breathing is affecting how we live. But coming back to the whole geographical location, so what we can do is try to treat within our own home environment or our own office environment potentially on things. But most people still have to go outside at one point or another. When we see all of these different things that show up on, whether they're on newscast or whether we go and look at things like pollen count or particulates and air pollution indices and things like that, those really can come into play as far as our overall breathing. It's not just something that they've added as extra bells and whistles on a weather program somewhere.
No, I mean, if you are, you know, if you do suffer from allergies, and, mm-hmm. then those numbers do matter, and it's not something that, you know, is sort of just made up. You walk outside and you start realizing in a couple hours that, you know, you're sniffling more, you're sort of sneezing, your eyes are watery, you feel congested, you might have a lot of phlegm in your throat, which would make your job as a radio host much more difficult.
Oh, believe me, it's done that in the past. Yeah.
But those kinds of things are, you know, can be managed, you know, to a degree, you know, with over-the-counter medicines. And I think it's a matter of expectations, you know, to sort of say, well, oh, this, you know, tablet says it's going to give me 24-hour relief, and just because they sort of look like that in the commercials and everyone's sort of happy, that's not quite how it works. But the whole idea is to make it as manageable as possible.
Exactly. And in many cases, we may be treating the symptom because we can't change everything in the environment right away anyway. I know there are some people out there with goals of cleaning up the environment and doing all this, but there are just natural allergens that are not man-made that are just going to always be there for some people. So the environment, I just wanted to establish that the environment does play a big part in this. And in many cases, maybe the best you can do is to treat symptoms in many cases.
Right. There are also not just over-the-counter medicines, but prescribed medicines as well. And some people, you know, need their allergies are so severe, so, you know, debilitating that, you know, seeing an allergy specialist, including getting testing for specific allergens and potentially immunotherapy and being able to, you know, get, you know, weekly shots to sort of try to make it more tolerable. Again, those are the sort of goals and it's expectations. It's not going to be, you know, this thing is going to make everything 100% better. You know, see in a year, it's going to be, well, what works for you and time of year is worse for you and what kind of things do you need at what times of year to make things tolerable.
And I would imagine, I think I know the answer to this question, but all the factors that we're talking about so far, do they treat everyone similarly? Are these things, or will people have, is it possible that I could have an allergy to one thing, but my wife or my kid may have an allergy to something totally different?
Absolutely.
Or reaction to
it. Absolutely. And everyone's is a little bit different in what they can do. It's there's a strong genetic component for it. So your children are more likely to have it if you've had it, but not necessarily if your wife not had it. And again, some of the things that you can sort of fix, short of being able to sort of completely remove yourself from the allergen, it's a matter of sort of getting things under control.
You mentioned also the word immunotherapy, which is basically a desensitization. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you describe what that is for people who maybe have some severe allergic reactions to everything from newsprint to cat dander? And how does immunotherapy come into play in trying to deal with things like different allergies?
There are some disease processes that require certain injections of medicines to help decrease something like IgE levels, which is a protein your body makes, or a patient who's made sort of too much, a way to sort of reduce it. But immunotherapy from allergists where they specifically find a specific antigen, something that makes them sick or makes them sort of react, that they're able to sort of take a very, very small dose of it and over time have the body sort of body's reaction become muted to that allergen and make it so they, if they were able to get a – if they had an exposure like mm-hmm. peanuts or something mm-hmm. like that, it would make that less deadly or less of a problem.
Right. And I know people who, for instance they're absolutely cat lovers, yet they have allergies to cats, to the dander, to the hair, whatever, with the cat. And they will literally go through immunology to be able to deal with that and be able to have their pet.
Right.
And it's very important for them to go through that. So,
I mean, a lot of things are for, about, your quality of life. And so, if you're if it's very, very important for you to have your pets and your cats, more than and you're willing to put up with, whatever you sort of have to put up with, then that's sort of what you sort of need to do. It's not illegal exactly. to sort of have a cat, but
right.
But the but there'd be consequences potentially.
Exactly. We have Dr. Charles Kim here with us. By the way, we have open phone lines if you'd like to join the conversation today. We're talking about lungs. We're talking a little bit here about allergies as well. We'll get into asthma, maybe a little bit about apnea. But if you'd like to join the conversation today here on HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS, open phone lines at 513-772-9658. Toll free anywhere in the country, 877-772-9658. A big thank you goes out always to UC Health for bringing some wonderful guests out our way, including Dr. Charles Kim, our special guest today, talking about good lung health. And, when we talk about all the things with allergies and whatnot, I think a lot of people don't always relate the ear, nose, throat part of this, which I guess, let me ask this. When we say upper respiratory, does that mean from the neck up? What does upper respiratory mean when we hear about somebody who has, let's say, an upper respiratory infection?
So, from the ear up, throat up. So usually we think about things, outside the chest, mm-hmm. Down to the level of the neck and the vocal cords, and then things, inside the chest, which would be, down in your lung, your bronchioles and such. Obviously,
they're all connected, right?
Exactly. You can't sort. Trying to remove one from the other, it doesn't usually.
Is interesting because I know some people who, the minute they get a cold or have something like that, it goes immediately to the chest. Some people, it stops at the throat. It's just amazing how different people react to different viruses and things like that. It's amazing.
It is that, and everyone's immune system is somewhat different, not just depending on their own health problems, but, medicines they, potentially can take can make them more vulnerable or less vulnerable. And then And then there's where they've been. That's another sort of a big factor. If you've been in the healthcare system or in a hospital, you're more likely to get certain kinds of organisms to cause pneumonia than people who are out in the community.
I think, too, talking about how this is all connected, people say, and we won't stay on allergies for the whole show, but one of the other things, because that is one of the more common, I have a feeling, one of the more common things that can affect the ear, nose, throat area, the allergies. We think, well, it makes a sneeze and all that, but does it really affect my lungs? But there can be secondary reactions and things like sinus infections and then potentially things that drain on down into the lungs. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. So something that does drain through the vocal cords and into the lungs, potentially can cause not just a bronchitis but sometimes a pneumonia as well. And the lungs reactions to allergens potentially can cause bronchospasm or wheezing. So not just a topical sneeze and runny nose, but potentially sort of wheezing and chest tightness and inability to sort of get air in and out as they'd like.
When somebody maybe discovers that they are wheezing, let's say, or that they're sneezing inordinately, more than you would just normally sneeze, maybe a couple of times a day, and you start noticing these patterns, is it a good time for them to maybe start keeping kind of a log before they would see a specialist or see their doctor and say, hey, I've noticed this seems to happen in this particular room of my house or at work or wherever? Does it help to keep some kind of a log?
I mean, I think it does for all the engineers who are listening. They keep, logs about everything and graphs. And I think that's always fun when they bring them in. It does help. Sometimes there's too much information. But most of the times, if you can – and people might even be able to do it themselves. They sort of say, well, every time I sort of come around this cat, I start coughing and sneezing. And then they realize that, maybe this cat isn't the cat for me. And they can sort of fix it themselves. A lot of – the cough – is one of the most common causes of a complaint to a doctor. In fact, like the second most common to physicals, just a well yearly physical. A lot of these primary care doctors and people in urgent cares, they see a lot of the coughs and they get solved sort of self-limited by themselves. But when it becomes a problem or when it's sort of persistent or recurrent, trying to see are there other sort of specialists who can sort of help get this resolved or sort of help improve the symptoms, and that's one of the parts of medicine that that my colleagues specialize in as well.
Dr. Charles Kim, our special guest, we're talking about lung health today and pulmonary diseases. He's with UC Health in the pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine area. And again, we'll probably touch a little bit on apnea in the second half of the show here today. If you'd like to find out more about UC Health, especially for our Butler County listeners out at Westchester Hospital, uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. They're also a great doctor's referral number, 513-298-DOCS. Deb always gets these great phone numbers, DOCS, D-O-C-S, or 513-298-3627. And we're talking a lot about the lungs today, but it's kind of hard to separate that, as we said, from the ear, nose, throat area. One of the things that I think has been a great breakthrough in the last really 15 to 20 years is the whole making available of a lot of the treatments over the counter now. A lot of the nasal sprays, a lot of the, I'm trying to think of things like Claritin and things like that,
right.
The antihistamines, thank you, that are just now available for anybody to just buy over the counter. The costs have come down to a certain extent on those, and they're no longer prescription. But you alluded to the fact that, again, I'm sure that different types of like loratadine versus or certain other antihistamines and things like that will react differently for different people. But for some people who have tried just about everything over the counter, seeing a specialist or talking to your doctor, there may be things that are a little bit more powerful, I guess.
Absolutely. Then there's more ways to sort of test to make things more specific and make treatments more personalized. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where being able to go from your primary care physician to trying the usual things that work for most people. But when the when your problems aren't sort of being able to sort of be fixed or they're continuous despite the usual sort of things, then referral to a subspecialist is a appropriate.
And sometimes the wheezing that we've talked about, that's kind of like you can literally hear yourself breathe. I've had that happen to me. And usually it's something right after I've been exposed to something that I have allergies to. And you'll notice maybe when you go to bed at night, quite often you might not hear yourself wheeze during the day. But at night when it's kind of quiet and you hear yourself maybe do that little wheeze, this could be the sign of an allergy issue. It could be the sign maybe, I guess, of asthma. Is asthma a possibility here as well?
Absolutely. So the wheeze that people hear or anyone hears is air going from a larger area to through a smaller area, and it's sort of the increase in the velocity that sort of causes that wheeze. And so if there's something obstructing the airway or sort of blocking the airway, not letting the air out from the lungs through, that could potentially cause a wheeze. And there's many different places it can sort of be obstructed, from the nose. If you have a lot of sinus drainage and there's a lot of congestion, then that can even cause a wheeze. Things in the back of the throat can cause a wheeze. And then there could be wheezes inside the chest as well that sometimes you can even hear without the stethoscope. It's usually associated with a cough that can potentially, clear the wheeze. You cough something up and the wheeze is gone.
Right.
But if it is persistent, then there are some even breathing tests that we can sort of use to look and see, what do you actually get out all the air that you're supposed to get out? And if you don't, does an inhaled medicine potentially sort of open up your airways and make it easier for you to get that air out? And those are specific pulmonary function testing that we perform routinely.
And once again, they're everything, as you said, from like inhalers, things like that, for things like asthma. And sometimes it may be may appear to be asthma, but it could just be an allergic reaction, I would imagine, sometimes too.
Yeah, so asthma is a conglomerate of much
right,
of different
right.
sort of things that we think. But some breathing tests can sort of help figure out, what kinds of things, what exactly sort of is it? Is it eosinophilic bronchitis? Is it just, acute bronchitis? Is it a persistent asthma or just intermittent? And so the way that we would think at least asthma is sort of a step up and step down therapy. So when you're having symptoms, wheezing or coughing, needing to use a rescue inhaler for we usually sort of say more than 3 times a week or waking up coughing more than 3 times a month, then we think about adding a controlling or a maintenance sort of inhaler, a medicine they use every day to help reduce the symptoms and try to get things under better control. And we, if we're not able to, then we add more things, add things up until things are controlled. And then once we're at control, then we sort of step down, we back off on things.
Before we take our break, I'll share one of the things that I'm sure probably 90% of the other people out there, if you've ever had to use an inhaler for asthma or for opening up something maybe after an infection or whatever, and that could be the result of either mucus or inflammation of some kind as well, or irritation. But the one thing that always gets me is they always tell you on the inhaler to exhale as deeply as possible before you inhale it. But for many of us, by that point, we're already gagging from the – I'm sure you've had this. But the key is if you take a couple of puffs on if that's what the desired or what the prescribed thing is, usually that second puff is a lot easier to get in. And that's really difficult sometimes.
There are other ways to get inhaled medications as well. Instead of just right at the lips, there's a spacer, which is a very useful sort of tool, and it creates it's basically a chamber that goes between the spacer and the patient's lips, and being able to inject the medicine into that sort of chamber and just breathe normally about 10 deep breaths will sort of get that medicine into the more lower airways where the medicine is sort of needed. And sometimes it helps for people who have problems with coordinating or people who are very under duress, if for an asthma attack or having breathing problems very acutely, and it makes it so it can help relieve that part of that. And then there's nebulized medicines, but that takes a little while to sort of get everything set up. And sometimes
if you're in an emergency situation where you need something quickly,
then having a spacer available would be very helpful.
Is that something I would ask my doctor about if I'm having a hard time using a regular, just a standard inhaler? Is that something I would normally ask my physician about?
You can get a prescription for it. The insurance companies, depending on on which,
sure.
Maybe even pay for it. You can get them at the drugstore and medical equipment companies as well. And if you're in a pinch, you know, if you have a styrofoam cup, all you need to do is basically sort of put a small hole on the sort of cup side on the bottom of it. You know, put the inhaler into that part and use the the mouth of the cup around your face and mouth and just being able to sort of get some space in between to
right. And I've even seen some. There are some inhalers that come with a spacer, even depending on which type of inhaler that is. So.
Right.
Very good. Dr. Charles Kim is here with us. And by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658. We're talking about good lung health here today. We've been talking about allergies, a little bit about asthma. We'll talk about smoking. We'll talk about even apnea. Are we okay to cover
sure.
apnea in the second half here? And just some good lung health, COPD. We'll talk about that as well. All that coming up on HealthScope. We hope you'll stay with us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, I hope you'll call us at 513-772-9658. You're listening to HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS.
The views and discussion expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of the hosts of the program or of WMKV Radio, Maple Knoll Communities, WLHS Radio, the Lakota Local School District, or its staff or management. Discussion of specific points and general topics on this program are not meant to be taken as specific professional advice.
And we're back on HealthScope here on WMKV and WLHS today, talking about lung issues, pulmonary disease, lung disease. And we have Dr. Charles Kim here with us, who is with UC Health in the areas of pulmonary care, critical care, and even sleep medicine. And he is also assistant professor of medicine with the University of Cincinnati. More information about UC Health at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital or at 513-298-DOCS. That's DOCS 3627 if you want to the numbers to go with that. Dr. Kim, when we're talking about lung capacity, I remember, and I threw this out during our break, a term that I remember from basic high school biology, which is vital capacity. Is that a term that's still used in lung and pulmonary
It
care?
Is. It's something we talk about mostly, I guess, among more pulmonary, doctors. Not so much general medicine. But one of the tests that we do to measure people's breathing is vital capacity is measured. Something called a pulmonary function test, where usually takes three. It's three different sort of parts of it. One is something called spirometry, where you are connected. You have a mouthpiece that goes to a machine, and we're able to sort of measure all the air that goes in your lungs and all the air you squeeze out of your lungs. And normally, we sort of have people breathe normally, then take a deep breath in and blow out as hard as you can. Keep going. We want to measure all the air that we can sort of get squeezed out there. How much air gets out in that first second versus how much you squeeze out completely. And we're also able to put people in a body box where you can that looks like a telephone booth where we can measure how much air is in your lungs completely, how much air is in your lungs when you squeeze it all out.
Wow.
We can also measure how well gases go from your lungs into your bloodstream, and all those numbers that people generate during this test, we compare them to other people of the same race, the same height, and the same age. And all those things, give us a predicted sort of value of this is what we expect you to be able to do and this is what you're able to do. And that sort of helps us, determine, we need to evaluate these kinds of diseases that might cause the kind of things that we see on this breathing, on the way that your breathing test looks like now. And then some people, serial breathing tests, so breathing tests maybe every 6 months or a year, to help sort of compare yourself to not just other people, but to yourself.
I was going to say establishing a baseline, especially if you have a history of lung illness or of pulmonary illness, having that baseline is really, really important, I would think.
So there are, lots of tests that when I see patients, the things that I ask them is, have you had a breathing test somewhere else that we can, maybe compare to where you are, what you're like now? Have you had a chest x-ray somewhere else? Have you had a CAT scan of your chest, somewhere else? All those kinds of things are very important, because if we have those kinds of information, it helps us sort of know, the things that we sort of see now, haven't changed over time, and that's that means something stable, and we don't need to worry about it so much, versus, this is something that wasn't there before, and it is now, and we need to, evaluate it further.
Yeah, and this is something that may or may not fall into the pulmonary, but just something that hit me. I just had a relative who was in the hospital for a procedure, and it still blows me away that they can put this little clamp on your finger, and it reads something called O2. What is that telling us?
So it's a pulse oximeter. It's okay. It measures how much oxygen is bound to the blood that goes through the smallest little vessels, and that's something that that again, what I've going through my training, I've heard of my professors in the 70s. Before they had pulse oximeters, right. You just sort of look at people. Do they look blue or not? And that's your sort of pulse oximeter.
But does that tell you how well the lungs are working?
It
or
tells
how
you,
well the pulmonary
it tells you how much
working?
Oxygen is in the blood and so normally it should be 92 or 94% saturated. Your blood should have lots of oxygen to mm-hmm. it. If there's a if it's low, then there's not getting as much oxygen to it, or potentially there's not as much blood flow going to that part where that sort of thing is the pulse oximeter is reading. It's a very useful test, and it's come a long way over the last 34 years. Where before, what I heard it was something that was as big as this sort of room, and $40,000-$50,000, and now you can buy them that fit in your pocket, over the internet for $30-$40.
Wow, it's just amazing, and it, to me, I always wondered how it could actually do that just by snapping onto somebody's finger, but that's probably more than we have time to go through in this show as far as how that goes. But I always wondered if, that basically gives you an overall picture, not just of the pulmonary health at that particular point, but I imagine several other things as far as...
Yeah, I mean, it does. It gives you, a number. It gives you, another piece of the puzzle of mm-hmm. what's going on with the patient. And everybody is, every patient's sort of different. And so, a lot of times, you want to make sure that you're treating the patient and not just the number or the X-ray
right.
or anything like that. But it, it's a very important part in being able to sort of measure things very easily and very quickly. There's a test called the 6-minute walk test where we basically have one of those pulse oximeters on your finger, and we have two cones about 100, feet apart, and we say, and we have a stopwatch, and we say walk, and we sort of see, well, how far can you walk? What does your oxygen levels look like when you're walking around? And that can tell us a lot of information, because at rest or when you're just sort of sitting there, you might look good. Everything might be sort of doing okay. But, if we get you to start getting up and exerting yourself, needing to use getting more than your vital capacity, mm-hmm. Are your lungs able to sort of keep up with that?
So when we talk about some of the more common breathing disorders, we've touched upon a few of these, but really a lot of this has to do with, and I guess you brought up a very interesting point to me, which is not just testing things when you're at rest and seeing what the vital capacity is, what the ability for the lungs to actually in with the good, out with the bad, if you will, when we're actually at activity. And now you start putting that together with people saying, well, yeah, when I'm a little more active, I tend to be kind of short of breath, or I might have little chest pains, things like that. Is that a concern for that should raise red flags, right?
It should. And there are lots of people that but sometimes it's pretty amazing how someone can sort of get through, doing all the things they need to do around the house or getting through their job or getting through their work, despite, what their numbers would sort of show, if we sort of tested them.
If some kind of a lung issue is diagnosed or at least suspected, how do you go about screening? How do you go about testing? And how do we find out or pinpoint what the issue might be if we're having some kind of a pulmonary issue?
Some of the breathing tests that we sort of talked about, mm-hmm. They measure your pulmonary function. There's imaging tests. X-ray is the most simple and sort of most time-honored one that gives us lots of information. A CAT scan of the chest, which is hundreds, thousands of X-rays, sort of done all at once and put through a computer to give us a very, very detailed image of the lungs.
Almost three-dimensional, I guess.
They can be built into three dimensions as well. And those help give us an idea of what's going on. And sometimes if we see things that are abnormal in the x-rays, that such as fluid that's built up inside the chest, maybe not necessarily in the lung, but maybe in the space between the lung and the chest wall, that can potentially be sort of drained out, and analysis needs to be, potentially needs to be done for things like that. There's little spots that we could potentially can see in the lungs, or even lymph nodes in the chest cavity that might need to be sampled, and sometimes that might require a procedure called a flexible bronchoscopy, where usually it's done as it can be done as an outpatient, where patients would get medicines to make them kind of sleepy, and then we have a camera that's kind of floppy, small, about 6.8 millimeters, and we can go through your nose, go through the back of your throat, through your vocal cords, into your airways and your lungs, and look around, take some washing samples. If there's things that need to be biopsied, things can potentially be biopsied, just do that without opening you up or sort of, putting needles from the outside, in.
That's just amazing. I mean, and you've been in medicine for some time, but are there things that you, when you were starting to learn this field of medicine and starting to really get into it, and you said you wanted to be a doctor since you were a kid, but could you have fathomed when you were just starting medicine some of the things that are being done today?
No, it really is amazing that the amount of technology and the concepts and it takes a lot of bravery for the doctors who are doing these kinds of things that no one's ever done this before. Let's try to see what happens if we try doing it. That takes a lot of guts to do things like that, and so there's a lot of innovation that happens not just by the docs at UC, but around the world, and there's national societies and that sort of collaborate together to sort of say, well, what is really going on, what can we really sort of do, to sort of fix things, and it's going on at a incredible sort of level that I think people don't sort of can really sort of appreciate, but it's going on sort of every day.
And the ability to do this in a non-invasive fashion where you're not cutting somebody is just amazing to me. I mean, that's tremendous.
Right. And a lot of things that we do, if we can avoid, procedures or do things that avoid things that might, make a patient have to stay in the hospital longer or have to sort of come in the hospital at all to get an answer, then that really is, I think, a benefit for the patients.
We have open phone lines at 513-772-9658 or 877-772-9658. Our special guest today, Dr. Charles Kim, here on HealthScope, Assistant Professor of Medicine with the University of Cincinnati and with UC Health at Westchester Hospital. They also can find out anything about any of the doctors that are guests on our program or about any of the physicians with UC Health at 513-298-DOCS. That's 513-298-DOCS, and we're talking about pulmonary care, a little bit about sleep medicine we'll talk about here as we go, but before we get to that, I want to talk about the whole idea of smoking. We have heard this, anybody in, and I'm in my mid-50s, anybody in my generation or younger has heard about all the detriments of smoking, and we're not here to just get on a pulpit about smoking, but you've seen, I'm sure, firsthand what can happen to the lungs when there is exposure to smoke. Firsthand, I imagine, is the worst. But what about this whole issue of secondhand smoke that has come about in the last 10 years?
It is a problem. It's hard to quantify exactly, how much secondhand smoke, one person gets versus another. But secondhand smoke is a lot of unfiltered smoke that comes in directly without, without the filter of a cigarette. It is something that can affect other people. I think people are more, aware of it, and smokers are being more conscientious about it and trying to take smoking outside. And obviously there's a lot more bans, even just since I've started my residency in different cities and countries about smoking in public areas and making it so but that's something that we've sort of seen a lot, and I think for a good reason. Secondhand smoke is bad. It's probably not, it's not as bad as firsthand smoke, and that really, it's the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. They estimate about 480,000 people, will die from smoking that wouldn't necessarily need to. And that's more than motor vehicle accidents and firearm injuries and illegal drug use and alcohol use all combined.
Wow.
And so, you know, it is something that, you know, sort of affects, you know, billions of dollars of industry, you know, in the United States, not just from people who succumb to illnesses from smoking, but you know, lost productivity and things like that. But you know, if it was that easy to sort of quit smoking, then people would sure. you know would quit. And so it really is something that you know, I try to work with patients in helping quit. You know, nagging them and sort of telling them, I think
right,
you know,
right, exactly.
You know, by the time a patient comes to a physician, a pulmonary doctor, they realize that, you know, smoking is probably not a good thing for them. But it's not that, you know, again, if it was that easy to quit, then they would have already quit.
And we can't live without our lungs. I mean, we have to have our lungs. That is the point, as you pointed out earlier in the program, in which the air, as you termed it, the fuel of our body gets put into the bloodstream. The lungs bring the air in. It allows the exchange to put the oxygen into the bloodstream and then get rid of the carbon
dioxide
that will basically help cleanse the body of the waste product. What actually happens when we get smoke or other kind of irritants like that into the lungs? Does it destroy part of the lung tissue? Does it coat it? What does it do?
Over time, it does cause destruction, including emphyseminous changes, you know, chronic bronchitis as well can, you know, lead to more mucus production and more coughing, shortness of breath, and also, you know, increases risk for malignancies as well, not just in the heart, but or in the lungs, but kidneys as well. So, you know, if
It sounds, I mean, we've seen photos and things like that that people have used, and it is a little scary to think what can happen within the lungs. And it's not an easily replaceable organ. I mean, there are transplants, I guess, that are available, but nonetheless.
Transplants, you know, are not routinely done as well as, you know, kidney transplants or heart transplants or liver transplants for people routinely living, you know, 10, 20 years. You know, our sort of numbers are, you know, 5-year, 50% survival. So after 5 years, only half the lung transplant, you know, patients are still alive. It's a very dangerous sort of procedure to do. And lots of medicines you need to help protect your lungs from the from everything else outside, and including the body reaction to it, is significant.
Dr. Charles Kim, our special guest today, and we have Pam, who is on the phone here with us. Pam from California. Thanks, Pam, for calling in. You're on HealthScope.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon,
hello.
I guess.
That's right. Pam, it's morning for you, but...
Still morning for me. First of all, a comment about smoking. I have never smoked. I had a friend who was a 3 or 4-pack-a-day person, and she said to me once, this is when I was still in New York, and I don't know whether it was nearly as polluted as we are out here. She said, Pammy, if I didn't know better, I'd swear you smoked, because I coughed and I cleared my throat a lot, and I don't know. All I could think of, it must be. And she knew I didn't, but she said, I swear, it just absolutely, if I didn't know better, I'd swear you did. And I just wonder if that was the effect of secondhand smoke.
So it depends on, you know, how much exposure you would have had to secondhand smoke. But also there are lots of other causes that cause people to sort of cough and have chest congestion that aren't necessarily related to smoking, but have a similar sort of treatment pathway and similar sort of symptoms.
Well, that leads me to the next question. Now, we live in a part of California that is very, very polluted. I mean, we have no burn days. I mean, I guess we're trying to get a little bit better, but there's been a real push on to try and clean up the air. And I've been noticing, and so has my partner Dave, we have been noticing, especially over the past few weeks or months, there's always, seems like there's always a little post-nasal drip, a little phlegm in my throat, and I mean, I just coughed just now, and we have had the windows open more because the air has been very pleasant and cool. But I'm just wondering, and I do take in fact, I take three medications for my allergies. If I let them settle in my ears, I start to get vertigo and totally blind. That's hard to travel when you think you're on a cruise ship and you're not. I'm just wondering, is there anything else I can do to just be glad that when it doesn't get into the ear and just put up with the little coughs and the feeling of something coating the throat?
I mean, you know, there's even over-the-counter nasal rinses that can be used to help try to you know, wash out any kind of allergens. You know, things like a neti pot or sinus rinse kits. Those other things can be used in addition to medications. But sometimes, you know, changing the environment, if it's you know, certain things outside that you notice, or when you have the windows open, that's causing significant problems, and that maybe you know filtered air, you know, might be better, especially if there's a lot of pollution out there.
Oh my God, I can't stand air conditioning as it is. He hates it.
Well, and that's what we were talking about before, that unfortunately the insurance companies won't cover your cost of moving to a place with cleaner air.
That's true. That's well, right. I guess I'm okay. But no rinses, I had not heard of that.
Yes, there's, you know, you can get usually at grocery stores. And in fact, I use one, something called a neti pot, where it looks like a little teapot. You fill it full of warm water, warm clean water. There's salt packets that are pre-measured that you can put in there to give it the right tonicity, so it's not stinging or burning. And you know, and it sort of goes in one nostril while you're breathing through your mouth, and fills up the cavity, and sort of drains out and goes out the other nostril. And if you do it over a sink, it sort of you know, helps you sort of expel some of those or wash out some of those. Just the
so that would maybe
that
eliminate some of this stuff in my throat, because sometimes it's very I mean, it's on a scale of 1 to 10, it's about a 12, but it's there.
And, you know, and sometimes it might be more than just sore medicines and might need to be, you know, looked at a little bit
right,
more.
Right, exactly. And as with everything, Pam, we you know our standard
thing is
always check with your doctor on that. But that's but it is interesting. I know several people who have been using things like the neti pots and have had some good luck with it. So
that's good to know.
Very good.
And now both of us have hypertension. So I suppose the salt that's going in there it's not going to stay in our system. And we even eat a little salt, but I don't use it in cooking. But we do try to watch it. I suppose it's not that important, the minor amount that you're going to get.
No.
All righty. Well,
very good.
Very much.
Well, Pam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, George. Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you. See now, like the neti pot, where it goes in one nostril and out the other. My wife, when she talks to me, it goes in one ear and out. Anyway, that's a whole nother topic. But we have Dr. Charles Kim here with us for a couple of more minutes. And let's get to, I guess, one of the other very serious issues. And it's not fair to do this in a couple of minutes, but lung cancer. One of the areas that is very, very important to talk about. What are the current treatments if someone is discovered to either have a spot or a small lesion or something in the lung? What are the different types of treatments that people have available to them when it comes to lung cancer?
So lung cancer is a very serious disease. It's the number one cause of cancer deaths. In fact, there's more people who die from breast cancer, colon cancer, pancreas cancer, all combined, and so and one of the reasons is there's not really an early warning sort of sign for lung cancer, and unfortunately, by the time people do have symptoms that might be attributed to the lung cancer, it's at a stage where curative surgery is not necessarily an option, or you know might not necessarily be an option at all. At that point, chemotherapy and radiation therapy help to you know try to reduce the bulk of the disease. Potentially, can help some of the things, but but it's a very serious disease that unfortunately many, many people will pass away from, and there won't be a way to sort of necessarily say, well, you know, this is, you know, if I only, you know, paid attention to this or that, that would have, you know, made me more likely, you know, the only other sort of possibility is to sort of not smoke, because, you know, about 80% of these lung cancers are probably attributed to smoke or, you know, sometimes occupation. And sometimes it's just unfortunate people do get these even if they don't. And so that's, there shouldn't be a stigma attached to, right. To it as well. But it is something that there are new screening tests for people who are age 55 to 80 who have over a 30-pack-year smoking history. So the number of packs, you know, cigarettes they smoke a day for how many years. Even if they've quit up to the last 15 years, then they could, you know, potentially be eligible for a lung cancer screening CAT scan, low-dose CAT scan of their chest to look for some of these spots and see if any of these spots are things that need to be biopsied or taken out. And that would be the best way to sort of get to a cure for cancer is by cutting out an early, you know, detected spot. It's more than just for taking a pill and sort of saying, oh, everything's okay. It's a significant thing that needs to be done, but it could be life-saving.
From the standpoint of the screening, is it mainly just smokers who need to be concerned about possibly having a screening? Could family history play into this or anything?
So it really is, smoking, people with a significant smoking history and a certain age as well. It's something as well that you know, just sort of can pop out of the blue that we sort of see, you know, quite often and unfortunately in a stage where it is, you know, past where something where we can say, well, we can, you know, get rid of this. We can, you know, say that we can cure it.
Where would you like to see pulmonary medicine going in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think if there be more, resources to help patients who have COPD, that's a disease that I think is just a very unfortunate disease, you know, that it's occurred over, you know, periods of, you know, decades to a patient that, and it's not until they're later they can sort of go back and sort of say, wow, I wish I, you know, would have done this or would have done that, and so when they get to that point and there's, you know, not a whole lot more options that we can sort of do that's that medical technology sort of has, more research to that. And there are, you know, some new trials even being done at University of Cincinnati to try to do new methods for treating, advanced COPD that doesn't require surgery. They're very exciting sort of things coming up. They always seem to be, you know, I wish I had it yesterday.
Right.
But it is coming up.
If we look at how far we've come and where we may be going in the future, if it can grow exponentially, we'll have some of these wonderful things happening, I hope. So, Dr. Charles Kim, thank you for being here. We're going to have you back because I didn't get to the apnea. We didn't really touch much upon COPD at this point, and those are two other issues that I would really love to explore on a future HealthScope program. But thank you so much for being here with us today.
You're welcome.
Very good. Dr. Charles Kim, Assistant Professor of Medicine. He is also with UC Health, Pulmonary Critical Care and Sleep Medicine. You can find out more about any of the UC Health physicians at uchealth.com/Westchester Hospital. Also, you can find out more about any of the doctors or physicians at 513-298-DOCS. A big thank you to Dr. Charles Kim. Thanks to Deb for being here with us today as well. You've been listening to HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS.
You've been listening to HealthScope on WMKV and WLHS and streaming around the world at WMKVFM.org. Join us each week at this time for a discussion of the latest in medical technology issues and topics on 89.3 WMKV, 89.9 WLHS, and online at WMKVFM.org.